Next on the agenda, we've already heard a little bit from him during the question and answer session earlier. Rafael Landowitz from UCLA is going to be speaking about antiretrovirals for HIV prevention, optimizing the use of PrEP and PEP.
Thank you, Dr. Cheever, and thank you all for staying for this. After Dr. Overton's presentation, I personally would have been done for the day. It's definitely a difficult act to follow. So I realize that these are my disclosures. I realize that a lot of you are very, very focused on treatment, and there may not be room or opportunity in your clinics to deploy biomedically based prevention. That is, of course, understanding that treatment is prevention. But I really want to galvanize all of you that as much as possible within your clinical settings and with the resources that are available to consider implementing PrEP in your clinics as well. I realize that's easier said than done, but I think in the workshop this afternoon we'll talk about some ways that might be doable, and we'll learn from each other's experience for those of you who are interested but have not yet found ways to be able to do that in your clinical practices. These are the objectives for this afternoon. I think anyone who's ever heard me talk before, or a number of people have sort of stolen these images because I love them. This is sort of my way of trying to characterize the divergence of primary efficacy data there is around TDF-FTC-based PrEP in the clinical trials that ultimately led to its regulatory approvals. And you know, I know a lot of people put up tables, and they're loaded with data, and they're loaded with information, and they're completely overwhelming, and I have no idea what to do with them. So when I created these images, I thought of, you know, at Christmas time, the church and synagogue bazaars, you know, that have a thermometer up for fundraising outside, and, you know, they fill it up as the fundraising happens. And when I first made these slides, I was showing it to some colleagues, and I said, isn't this great? And you see the voice trial in the lower left corner there where there's the puddle because there was this negative effect. And I said, well, you know, should I do a puddle? Should I do a shadow? Should I do a reverse image? What should I do? And the person said, definitely don't do a puddle. And the reason they said that was I didn't originally use blue, I used red in the original. So you can imagine that made a lot of sense. I will share with you that I keep a version of this slide at home in yellow because it makes me giggle. But you can understand why the differential levels of efficacy that were seen in all of these trials, especially between men and women, were confusing to providers, confusing to potential consumers of PrEP. And we'll come to what the origin of those differences were in a second. Hopefully many of you know the punchline here. There's really two punchlines. I do want to point out that what Dr. Sag referenced and Dr. Thompson referenced earlier, the Eipergaze study in the lower right corner there is that 211 on-demand PrEP study that showed an 86% efficacy among MSM, and the Beret signifies that it was done in Quebec and France, so I hope that's clear. But all of these have been published and reviewed and discussed extensively, which brings us to our first question. The differences in clinical trial efficacy for TDF-FTC PrEP are attributable to, and this is implied across these various studies. Is it intrinsic efficacy differential between males and females? Is it differences in tissue or compartmental pharmacokinetics? Is it adherence? Is it absorption differences? Is it the second and third choice, or is the third and fourth choice? And you can go ahead and vote. Ooh, it's the Lion King. Okay, great. So, hello. How do we see the results? There they are. Okay, so we have good. It's always good when you have a wide variety of people responding. I like 2 and 3 as the best answer because there are differential pharmacokinetics in the rectal and vaginal compartments. Particularly the tenofovir gets in about 100-fold less well into the cervicovaginal tissues as it does into rectal tissues. So it's not a sex difference, it's a tissue penetration difference, which which really suggests we need better issues. And of course, I think the punchline that you all know so well is that the efficacy of the product correlates extremely tightly across all these studies with biomarkers of adherence. And this is not a surprise to any of you. This is true across a wide variety of disciplines. If you don't take a medication, it doesn't work. And that was the differences across a lot of those efficacy studies. In a lot of those studies, particularly the negative ones, people did not take the drug sufficiently frequently to get the protection. And of course, we've learned that because of that lower penetration of these particular antiretroviral drugs into cervicovaginal tissues, there is less forgiveness to non-adherence for vaginal protection as compared with rectal protection. Hopefully that makes sense. It's the combination of two. It's the genital route of exposure as well as adherence that led to those differences in efficacy. So now that there are regulatory approvals in an increasing number of countries and we're working towards implementation, you can see on the left, and this is data from Gilead actually, about how there's been an inflection point, an enormous uptake of PrEP, particularly in U.S. populations. The question comes, are we getting PrEP as an effective prevention strategy to the most at-risk individuals? And the answer is clearly not. And I'm sure all of you know that all too well. On the left of those three pie charts, you see the U.S. Population divided by race, ethnicity. In the center is a pie chart depicting the number of new HIV diagnoses, at least in 2015. Notice that's not incidence, that's just new diagnoses. And you'll notice that the race-ethnicity distribution of that center pie chart is very different than the population-based one on the left. But if you look at who's using TDF-FTC PrEP in the pie chart on the right, it looks a lot more like the overall population than who's being most affected by HIV, doesn't it? Which suggests that we still have an enormous amount of work to do about getting PrEP into communities that are most affected by HIV in the U.S. So I was specifically asked, just before I talk more about PrEP in particular, to talk about this specific case of you have someone who's had an exposure and they're getting post-exposure prophylaxis, and you think you want to get them on PrEP. How do you do that? Can you do that? Is there a strategy? And you all had a pretest question about this in your materials. And it was actually really interesting. There was a sort of bimodal breakdown of the way people responded to this. So I want to take just a second and remind everyone that PEP is an emergency response to an acute exposure. And I think the context that we're going to be thinking about for this conversation has to do with people who might be recurrently at risk. So you think they might be someone who would use PEP multiple times, not just an isolated experience, the kind of thing we think about with a needle stick when it happens in a healthcare-related setting. And the question comes up every time you see someone for at least sexually-related PEP, is this person potentially a candidate for pre-exposure prophylaxis? And while it's important to confirm that the person was HIV uninfected before they started PEP, and again when they've finished the post-exposure course, there is never going to be a perfect way to exonerate HIV infection at the conclusion of the PEP course. Right, so we know that PEP is three drugs, PrEP is two drugs, so really the question on the table is, can I safely de-escalate a three-drug PEP regimen to a two-drug PrEP regimen? Right? And the short answer is, there are no data to help us here, so I'm just going to give you a best practice approach. Right? What's the concern? The concern is, if the PEP really failed, so either they were infected before you started or somehow the PEP didn't work, could you have been suppressing real infection with that three-drug regimen that would then explode or venture forth when you de-escalate to the two-drug regimen? And sure, that is a theoretical possibility, but really, if you force someone after a PEP course to take a break from biomedical prevention, and they're currently at risk, it's just another opportunity for someone to get exposed and potentially infected, isn't it? And suppose you sent an RNA at the end of that PEP course to assure yourself that they're negative. Is that even a good assurance? And the answer is no. because we may never be able to say that that three-drug regimen wasn't suppressing viremia in someone who really had HIV infection. So the general guidance, and this has been sort of discussed in really an opinion paper that aggregated a bunch of data by Steve Safran and Ken Mayer and their group, that really the best thing to do is at the end of that 4-week PEP course, send a antigen antibody instrument based test, and then immediately and seamlessly de-escalate to the 2-drug regimen and keep on going. That is sort of intrinsically a little uncomfortable to most of us, but I think if someone is really recurrently at risk, that is probably the better part of valor. There are, of course, no data to guide this, so any approach might be appropriate in a given setting. And in the workshop this afternoon, we can talk about some different scenarios where some different strategies might be appropriate. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the most common question that I get asked about PrEP, and that's, well, so someone didn't tolerate it, they don't like daily oral TDF-FTC, and they don't want to do this 2-on-1 thing. What else you got for me? I got a whole bunch of other antivirals in my armamentarium. I can use those for PrEP, right? No. Please don't. A lot of people were excited about Maraviroc, right? Maraviroc's a CCR5 receptor antagonist. Its mechanism is against HIV entry. It's very attractive from a prevention approach. You might think that it would work. And so this was actually developed, and there were some non-human primate macaque models that suggested that this might be a good strategy. And then it got into phase 2 studies in humans, and it was a collaboration between the ACTG and the HPTN. And they enrolled 2 cohorts. There was an MSM trans women cohort and a cis female cohort, and I'll come back to the details of that in a second. They ultimately enrolled 600 people. These were at-risk individuals, and they randomized them. It was double-blind, double-dummy, and it was a 4-arm safety study. And I can't say this enough. This was not powered to show efficacy. And you'll see over on the right, this arm 4, the anchor arm was TDF-FTC, so our standard PrEP regimen. And that's what they were comparing everything to. And you can see the other experimental arms. There was Maraviroc alone. There was Maraviroc with FTC and Maraviroc with TDF. And then there was a companion sub-study that went with it, where they did rectal and, for the women, vaginal biopsies to try and see the tissue levels. Now, you're thinking to yourself, who would sign up for such a study? Well, happily, 600 people did, and so we do have some information to share. I will tell you, in the MSM and trans women cohort, there were 5 seroconversions. All 5 of them were in an arm that contained Maraviroc. 4 of them were Maraviroc alone. 1 was Maraviroc and TDF. And while your immediate reaction to that may be, well, that's the end of that, I want to point out something that's in the right-hand column of this table. 4 of the 5 individuals who seroconverted had no evidence of detectable drug in their blood plasma. And as we discussed when we talked about TDF-FTC, doesn't work if you don't take it. So it is completely unclear, and the study was not powered to make this distinction. Did this drug not work because it doesn't work for PrEP, or did it not work in these cases because people weren't taking it? And we don't know the answer to that question. Again, not powered for efficacy, so we can't say anything about that. The confidence intervals of the incidence rates for HIV overlapped tremendously. But I will share with you that the companion rectal biopsy sub-study for this was a little provocative, right? So what they did was they took people in each of those 4 arms, did rectal biopsies, and in a petri dish, you dump laboratory strains of HIV onto these biopsies and see how infectable these tissue samples are that contain tissue with the drug in it, right? And the answer was the ones that had just Maraviroc in it were much easier to infect in a laboratory setting than the other arms. So probably because of that combination of issues, this has not progressed into phase 3 efficacy studies, and I'm not sure if it ever will. And without that efficacy data, I think it would be unwise to go forward with using Maraviroc clinically in a PrEP context. The second most common thing I get asked about is TAF. TAF-FTC, can we use it for PrEP? So here's another question for you all. Which is false about TAF? I know you've had a lot of discussions about TAF in the treatment context already, so hopefully everyone will find this like cake. TAF is cleared more quickly from the plasma of women than men. TAF is metabolized to tenofovir itself less in the blood plasma than TDF is. TAF is known to concentrate in rectal or cervical tissues better than TDF, or TAF-FDC has been shown to work equally well to TDF-FDC for prevention. Little Mermaid, nice. Okay, let's see. Okay, great. So it looks like the majority actually chose the right answer. TAF is metabolized to tenofovir less in blood plasma than TDF is. That is true. Interestingly, almost a third of people said it's been shown to work equally well to TDF-FDC for prevention. Excellent. I'm glad a lot of you said that. Not true. So here's the issue. Right, so I think you've all seen this slide before. TAF gets into cells before it is metabolized at a much higher rate than TDF does. Right, tenofovir is the active metabolite. With TAF, you get more tenofovir intracellularly. With TDF, you get more tenofovir in the blood plasma. That's postulated to be the reason for the differential toxicity on kidneys and bone. But we have no, and it seems to not have an effect on treatment efficacy, but the question is, does it work for prevention? And we don't know. And the reason we don't know is we don't know what the best correlate of prevention is. Is it blood plasma levels? Because if it is, TAF shouldn't work. Is it intracellular levels? Because if it is, TAF will work great. Is it genital tissue levels? Interesting question. So single-dose studies of TAF with FTC showed that TAF did not get tenofovir metabolites into rectal tissues or cervicovaginal tissues well at all. There was just an abstract presented about a month ago that suggests that you may actually get better levels with multiple dosing, but that's not completely clear yet. And there have been some macaque challenge models that showed that despite there not being good levels in the genital tissues, macaques were protected against both rectal and vaginal challenges when you used TAF. So we have conflicting evidence in these non-human primate and these tissue pharmacokinetic models. How about in humans? Does it work? Great question. There's a fully powered efficacy study that is now fully enrolled and in follow-up. It's in MSM and trans women, and it compared TAF-FTC to TDF-FTC, and it's looking at HIV incidence as its primary outcome measure. We do not know the results of this study yet. We're expecting to hear something next year, so sometime in 2019, we are expecting to see some results. But I have a very difficult time recommending that we use TAF-FTC as a PrEP agent without these data being available. Now, some of you are going to say, and we can have a brisk discussion about this in the workshop in the afternoon, what if you have someone who's, you know, got renal dysfunction and they can't tolerate TDF-FTC? And, you know, with appropriate caveats, would you ever, in any circumstances, think about prescribing it? And that's a really nuanced conversation. So let's talk about that this afternoon if people are interested in talking about that. But please wait for those data. I'm now going to move on to long-acting agents. And you've already heard a lot about these long-acting injectable and oral agents in the treatment context, but they're also being developed for prevention, and I think they're really exciting. Of course, as you've already heard, this liability, this question, big question mark about these particularly long-acting injectable agents is this tail, the pharmacokinetic tail. Is it a good thing? Does it give you prolonged protection? Or is it just tremendous liability where there's not protection and you could get infected and then get integrase-resistant virus, and that would be a disaster, right? And we don't know the answer to that. Rilpivirine, right, which has FDA approvals as a short-acting daily pill, is available as a long-acting nanosuspension. It's being developed in combination. You've heard about this already, in combination with cabotegravir for maintenance of treatment. And that's all really exciting. It was studied in a prevention context in a phase 2 study, a really sexily named trial called HPTN-076. Sexy, right? And they looked at HIV uninfected low risk women and administered long acting cabotegravir. And you'll notice all of these prevention trials have a similar format. On the left-hand side of the trial design, everybody got a four-week oral lead-in to make sure there were no side effects to the agent before administering the long-acting preparation of it. And this was a placebo-controlled study, which is okay to do when you have low-risk individuals, right? So this was either the pill version of rilpivirine or an oral placebo, and people who tolerated it sufficiently were given the intramuscular rilpivirine for a series of six injections that were given every 8 weeks, or they got a saline placebo, and then they were followed up. And the long story short was each of these injections that was used in the prevention context was a series of two milliliter injections that were given at the same time. Now, not at the same time as in drop your pants, here's two injections in your buttocks. They were given serially, one right after the other, at the same visit. The pharmacokinetics look good, but because of the cold chain required and the light sensitivity of this product, that's one reason it probably has not moved forward for prevention. I know it's moving forward for therapeutics, but in prevention context, it hasn't. But perhaps the more concerning finding was, of course, this question of this long tail being a liability, right? And this is from a phase one PK study where people got about a quarter of the dose that was actually used in the phase two study. And this was a low-risk female who got this 300 milligram dose of rilpivirine and then about 40 days later was exposed to HIV and seroconverted with NNRTI-resistant virus. So our worst fears about this pharmacokinetic tail were realized in this one participant, and this may have been the end of rilpivirine for prevention because of its at least perceived lower barrier to resistance in these sorts of contexts. So what else do we have? You've already heard a lot about cabotegravir, new strand transfer integrase inhibitor, structurally similar to dolutegravir, again, available both as a pill, short-acting, and a long-acting injectable. And, of course, this is the one that's moving forward into phase three trials that we'll talk about in just a second. So two phase two trials supported the ongoing development of this agent. Again, a similar design to the one I showed you for the rilpivirine on the left side of your slide. You see a four-week oral lead-in and then moving on to a series of injections. This original study called ACLAIR was a ViiV-sponsored study that looked at every 12-week intervals. Again, it was two milliliter injections being given every 3 months. So there was a lot of excitement around this three-month interval because it could be potentially timed with some forms of injectable contraception. 3 months is quarterly, four times a year. It sounds very attractive, doesn't it? But of course, I think many of you know the punchline. What was expected to be the pharmacokinetics are shown here in purple. What they really saw is shown here in green from the ACLAIR study. And what's really important to notice is that bottom dotted line on this graph, that's the threshold based on the animal challenge models where you really dropped off in the rectal protection. So you didn't want to fall below that dotted line. And about 15 to 20% of people did fall below those line at the trough concentration with the every 12-week dosing. So because of that, and you can see here in blue on the left side the percentage of people after each injection who had those very low levels. And the pharmacokinetic tail in ACLAIR is shown in the right bar graph here. And what you can see, what you want to look at are the aqua bars, right? And the aqua bars, you can see that 52 weeks after the final injection, 17% of people still had detectable cabotegravir left in their system. So this drug's pharmacokinetic tail lasts a really long time. 17% of people still have it in their system a year after their final injection. That's something that makes you sit up and take notice, doesn't it? So HPTN-077, again, I know, sexy name, was the second phase two trial. The top bar shows the visit schedule that looks just like ACLAIR. So this started out as essentially an ACLAIR number two trial, just done in men and women in global settings. But when those pharmacokinetic data came back from the ACLAIR study, we designed, and on the bottom, a second dosing schedule where people would get a slightly smaller dose but less frequently. So it's one 3-milliliter injection, still gluteal, given every 8 weeks, and you have to separate the first two injections by just a 4-week load. So it's a 4-week interval and then 8 weeks thereafter. So it was the same sort of format, oral lead-in, then these injections, and then follow-up. And we extended the follow-up to actually 18 months after the final injection to get a better idea, not only for men that were in the ECLAIR study, but for women also, what was the length of the pharmacokinetic tail. So what this shows was the pharmacokinetics, and you want to say blue is bad on this slide. You don't want blue. Blue is the level in those animal models where you didn't get protection. Very little blue here, right? You can see the blue is limited to the every 12-week dose. There's no blue either for males or females with the every 8-week dose. So that's why the every 8-week dose was chosen to move into the phase 3 studies. I hope that makes sense. The pharmacokinetic tail of long-acting ARVs, I hope everyone in this room gets this correct, is of no concern, can be overcome by hemodialysis, can be overcome by surgical excision of the molecular injection site, requires clinical study to determine if it's an advantage or a liability. Okay, what do we got? Excellent. I think some people are being facetious here. So just so you know, it cannot be overcome by hemodialysis. Cabotegravir is not dialyzable. We can talk this afternoon about some weird things that people have tried to reduce the levels, but hemodialysis does not work. I'm going to ask you in this very complicated slide to look all the way to the right. These were the findings of HPTN-077. 18 months after the final injection, top row is men, bottom row is women. You can see the number of people in orange who did not have detectable levels of cabotegravir left. That means everyone else did. So 18 months after the last injection, 13% of the men and 42% of the women still had detectable levels of cabotegravir. So one more time, 42% of the women 18 months after the final injection still had cabotegravir. Okay. What was important in determining the length of that pharmacokinetic tail? I'm going to ask you to look at the bottom row of this table. Here's the take-home message that I'd like you to remember. For the males, it took an average of 42.7 weeks after the last injection to get to undetectable. For the females, it took 66.3 weeks to get to undetectable. But look at the ranges. What is the high end of the range for the females? 182 weeks. That's 3.5 years. That is the longest anyone's levels were modeled to have persisted. So whether or not this is a liability to be determined, but it's an issue we need to pay attention to. So cabotegravir is now in phase 3 studies. There are two parallel ones, one in MSM and trans women, one in cisgender women. They all have a similar design. They're double-blind, double-dummy studies comparing cabotegravir to TDF-FDC for PrEP. The results are expected in 2021-ish. They could stop earlier if they're successful or if there's a concern, but that is when the results are anticipated and when you might hear about these results. I'm going to move on quickly to some other modalities, antibodies, monoclonal antibodies. Just quickly, you know that there's a long history of infectious diseases, people using monoclonal antibodies for prevention and treatment of various infectious diseases. Question for you, the best broadly neutralizing antibody for HIV treatment and prevention is VRC07523LS, 10E8, the tri-specific antibody, the antibody your cousin brewed in their basement. No one knows. Oh, please. Did he just say Hakuna Truvada? Okay. Okay. Sorry, I'm not allowed to use brand names. Donna, I apologize. Okay, so no one knows the answer at the time. That's right. The joke that I sometimes make is by the time this lecture has finished, there'll be a brand new antibody that's clearly the best thing anyone's ever seen, and I'll be asked to use it and test it. So in these long-term non-progressors and elite controllers, they've identified epitopes, which are conserved, and antibodies are being generated against them, and people are optimizing them in the laboratory for better potency and better breadth against more viruses. You can see the wide variety of antibodies with different and increasing breadths and potencies that are in various stages of development. It's all tremendously exciting. And in fact, one of them, VRC01, is in fully powered efficacy studies in two parallel studies in the MSM and trans individuals in the Americas and women in sub-Saharan Africa, 4,200 patients. And we're anticipating results sometime in 2020 to see if this works for prevention. No one thinks that VRC01 as an IV infusion is going to be a scalable intervention. But if this could be administered as a subcutaneous preparation, perhaps every 6 months, then maybe we have a conversation. And I think that's where people are going with this and why people are excited about it. You've heard about implantable devices and their challenges and their advantages. What's nice is you could remove them if there's a toxicity. They might not have that really prolonged tail if there is a side effect or if somebody decides they don't want to use it anymore. And there are these implants for prevention that are in early stages of clinical development that contain either TAF or cabotegravir or the MK5791, this EFDA product. And there are others in development. All really exciting, but all very early. You all know about the dapivirine ring, which completed efficacy trials in sub-Saharan Africa, demonstrating about 30% efficacy for HIV prevention. All really exciting. It's awaiting regulatory approvals. A lot of people sneer at the 30% efficacy result. But remember that something that might have a lower level of efficacy for prevention, but people are willing to use, might have a much more impactful public health benefit than something with really high levels of efficacy, but nobody wants. So I think we need to be a little bit careful before we pan something with 30% efficacy, particularly when that was a randomized blinded study and we're only beginning to understand what the use and the protection might be in an open label context. The last thing I will say, and I know Dr. Cheever, I'm already a minute over, but the last thing I want to say is super exciting, are these patches, these transdermal patches already being used to deliver vaccines. It's really exciting. They go through the stratum corneum, which is the barrier to large molecules, more than 500 Daltons getting through the skin, but they don't go so low as to impinge on the nerves. So they're not painful, even though they look a little scary. You can see an electron micrograph of what it looks like going through the stratum corneum. And it's really sort of exciting. There are these self-dissolving needles that could deliver antivirals or preventive agents for treatment or prevention, and they dissolve into the dermis and could get absorbed. So while this is in very early stages of development, there are now analogy to it being as immunogenic in a vaccine setting as some of these adjuvant vaccine strategies, and cabotegravir-based dissolving microneedles are already in development. So it's really exciting. The future, who knows? Maybe we're going to have these little finger-sized things that we just put on our skin, and that might be a way to deliver either treatment or prevention. So in conclusion, TDF-FTC PrEP has set a really high bar for preventative effectiveness. Long-acting preparations will solve some but not all of these challenges, but they'll be available very soon. The future is ripe with possibilities in implants, antibodies, and microneedles. We need more choices for people. And more options are always better. Thanks so much for your attention.
Hi, I'm Gary Spinner. That was a great talk. I wanted to get your input on how you think PrEP actually works. We talk a lot with our patients and with ourselves about cervical vaginal penetration, rectal penetration, but the macaque study in TAF showed there was really insufficient penetration, and yet it looked like it was efficacious. Are there other mechanisms that we're considering for how this actually works?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I don't think anyone knows the answer to this. I sort of rushed through it a little bit. I don't know if you heard me say, but there are data now that multiple doses of TAF do seem to accumulate in genital tissues. So I think we need more information. Nobody knows. Well, Craig Hendricks from Hopkins is pretty sure that he believes that it is genital tissue concentrations that are the determinant of protective efficacy. I think most people think the jury is still out.
Okay, a couple of quick questions on PEP. So a female HIV-negative person is in a relationship with an HIV-positive male, and they use condoms and the condom breaks. You don't know what the viral load is of the male. Would you recommend PEP for that person, that woman?
Sure. If you don't know what the viral load is, I do think that you lose absolutely nothing by immediately initiating PEP in the context of that exposure. If you subsequently find out that the HIV-infected source individual is on treatment and undetectable, I don't think there's a need to continue it. But because PEP is so time-sensitive, I always advocate, if there's any question, starting with a full 3-drug dose of PEP, and you can make further decisions later.
Could you recommend a person like that keep their PEP in the bedside drawer?
It's a great question. There have been a few studies of people having starter packs or things like that by the bedside. They've not been efficacy studies. I think it's a reasonable approach.
Okay, and would you recommend Biktarvy or Genvoya as PEP since it's one pill once a day?
I have a little bit of qualms about using a TAF-based PEP regimen at this time until we get more information. I don't think it's a crazy thing to do. There have been a couple of small studies that have shown safety of doing so, but I prefer a TDF-based regimen.
And now that TDF-3TC is available, could we use that instead of FTC?
There are no data that allow us to recommend that. You would think that it should be the same, but we don't know. We don't have the same sort of clinical data. We don't have the same sort of tissue penetration data for 3TC.
What are the tissue levels in neovaginal tissue of transgender women?
That is an outstanding question. The entire field of PrEP is data poor for trans individuals, and we need more information. If you're going to assume that it is colonic mucosa, it should be analogous, but there are a lot of things that should be that aren't. And I would remind people that there was some really provocative data presented by two different groups recently that feminizing hormones reduced tenofovir levels in trans individuals who were using them, in one case by more than 30%. We're not sure what the clinical implications of that, but that's concerning. So a lot of things that should be aren't, some things that shouldn't be are. We need data.
So that goes for if a trans woman is on hormones, would PrEP be effective, or we just don't know?
We don't know the answer to that question. The one study that enrolled a robust number of trans individuals that we have the data for to date had poor adherence that obfuscated our ability to tell about efficacy.
And what is the data on PrEP for injection drug users?
So there was one fully powered study called the Bangkok tenofovir study. It used tenofovir alone, not TDF-FTC, and it showed a 49% reduction in incidence for injectors. The problem with that study was that there was no difference in efficacy during the entire time period where people were using a lot of intravenous drugs. And of course, we know that TDF would be effective for sexual prevention of HIV. It was only after essentially most of the injection behavior had ceased that a difference was seen. So I certainly would not refuse it, someone with injection use, drug use behavior, but we don't fully have a handle on what the efficacy is against parenteral exposures.
Okay, and for patients that are going to be on intermittent PrEP therapy, how do they anticipate sex by 12 hours? Like, how did that happen in those studies?
We all should be so lucky. No, but that honestly, that is one of the challenges with on-demand PrEP. And if you can't anticipate it, that's not a good strategy for you.
And what about Truvada for patients with a creatinine clearance between 30 and 60?
What about it? So technically, the package insert does not support it. In fact, all the guidelines say don't do it. Come to the afternoon session, and we'll talk about some other strategies.
Okay, and given the increased concerns about dolutegravir and neural tube defects, does that change your thinking about post-exposure prophylaxis with dolutegravir?
It's a great question, and in fact, the CDC did issue a guideline about this, didn't they, saying very specifically not to use dolutegravir in women of childbearing potential after a sexual assault exposure. And I would say, well, why limit it to that if that's really a concern? Any woman of childbearing potential. I think until that question is fully answered, I probably wouldn't use it in a woman of childbearing potential, and I've gone back to using raltegravir in those contexts or a boosted darunavir like setting. But you need to be careful that you do not use cobicistat darunavir, because in pregnancy, right, you can't use cobicistat. So if someone were to become pregnant, that would be an additional concern.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.